Next case is 06703, Annie Hall versus Bank One Management Corp. Let me say before we begin, Mr. Kelm, I see you are here. Our rule requires counsel to check in with the clerk's office. My information is you haven't checked in. We'll let you argue, certainly, but next time, please follow the rule so we know. Let's wait till Mr. Kincaid has a chance to take notes on your argument here.
Mr. Chief Justice.
Wait till I call on you, please, Mr. Kelm. I said let's wait till Mr. Kincaid has a chance to I'm sure he wants to take copious notes on your argument. Okay, Mr. Kelm.
Thank you, Your Honor. Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the court. And my name is Russell Kelm, and I represent the plaintiff below, Ann Hall, in her case against Bank One. In this case, there is no dispute as to any of the facts regarding the issues before this court. There are purely legal issues here regarding the selection of a juror in this case. The particular juror involved was one who had three adult children who worked for Bank One, two of whom were currently employed by Bank One at the time of the trial. The plaintiffs were out of peremptory challenges at the time this juror was before the court, and the plaintiff moved for challenge for cause under the statute establishing challenges for cause 23-1342E. The challenge proceeded by the court's questioning of the jury to rehabilitate the juror, although it established that his children worked for one of the parties, was employed by one of the parties. The court inquired as to whether the juror could lay that aside and be fair and impartial despite the fact that his children worked for one of the parties. When he stated that he could, he sat on the jury, became the foreman of the jury, and led them to a defense verdict quickly after the case was delivered to the jury. The issue here today is one that has not been before this court previously in a civil case in the history of the court, and that is whether one of the principal challenges, other than an interest challenge that was before the court once before, whether the challenge for cause under the statute that is a principal challenge for cause is subject to rehabilitation by asking the juror, despite your disqualification, can you be fair and impartial otherwise to the parties, and then allowing the juror to sit. The principal challenges for cause are ones that were established in England in the 1200s. They're recorded specifically in Blackstone's commentaries in the 1700s. The Ohio statute is merely a codification of years of development of English common law. The Blackstone commentaries discussion of principal and for the favor challenges that appears in the 1700s is almost identically copied into the codification of challenges for cause in Ohio. So we're dealing with hundreds of years of history in this case.
Counsel, if I could just jump in here. There are sections A through J in the particular statute that you're talking about. And if I understand it correctly, your position is that the first nine should never be allowed to be rehabilitated, and it's only J where it says that the person discloses by answers that cannot be a fair and impartial juror.
J and 43, Justice Lansinger.
J and 43.
And section .43, right, which is the next statute.
Okay.
And the issue, J and section that's 23-13.43 were not a part of the original statute, were added later by the legislature, and really incorporate the challenge to the favor, which is a different challenge than the principal challenge that's codified in the first nine sections of section 4.42.
Although it doesn't say in 42 that there cannot be rehabilitation, the first nine.
Well, the mandatory language of the statute is the juror shall be removed. If you look at the last section, each challenge listed in this section shall be considered as a principal challenge and its validity tried by the court.
And the validity tried by the court doesn't suggest to you that the court should be allowed to determine if that person is a qualified juror?
Only to the extent that you determine whether you satisfied the qualifications of the principal challenge. In other words, the court has discretion to determine whether, in fact, a brother of one of the parties is seated on the juror.
Well, for example, in I, where it says that a person who's already served in the trial of a cause within the previous 12 months.
Correct.
If we accept your suggestion, then a court could never seat an individual who had been a juror within the 12-month period, even if that individual would appear to be otherwise qualified.
That's an issue for the legislature, not for the interpretation of the statute. I think literally under the statute, that's true, Your Honor.
All right. I just want to make sure what your position is.
That's absolutely true. And the history of the interpretation of these principal challenges for cause is that once the court determines in its discretion whether it's met, the juror is disqualified and cannot serve and cannot be rehabilitated. What's happened in the lower courts, however, is that the two challenges have been confused and conflated and placed together. And what happens is Section J, and actually the reverse of Section J, has been engrafted onto the first nine sections by some of the lower courts. And the reason I say that, Section J says that a court can determine in its discretion that someone cannot be fair and impartial. What courts do is they determine that the juror, despite the principal disqualification, can be fair and impartial, which is the opposite. So they're not even following Section J in the interpretation that they're giving.
We can still argue, though, that it's the validity being determined by the court. I mean, we know these days it can be very difficult to seat jurors when you call in an array, and let's say there are individuals who, by their answers, are very clearly not good jurors for that particular case. We also have the peremptory challenges.
Sure.
That allow for individuals to be deselected. Wouldn't your interpretation, taking away some discretion from the trial judge to seat a juror, cause it to be difficult to get jurors in a case?
No, Your Honor. The interpretation that I'm giving is one that Blackstone gave in 300 years of history has given to the principal challenges. And the discretion that the judge has to determine whether that principal challenge is met. The judge also has discretion under J and under point 4.3 to determine whether there's a challenge to the favor. In other words, that a person cannot be fair and impartial in the case. And they can make that determination separate from the challenge under the principal challenge statute. But once they make a determination that someone satisfies one of those nine provisions that codify the common law, that make them a principal challenge, they're disqualified and cannot serve regardless of any determination under J or point 4.3. And the reason for that is very simple. If a party's lawyer from a prior case is the lawyer in this case, can you really say to that person, I want you to set aside the fact that this man has represented you for 20 years and be fair and impartial in this case? And when they nod their head yes, are they really fair and impartial? The reason for these principal challenges are, through history, it's been determined that people have certain affinities because of relationships that disqualify them absolutely from serving as jurors. And can we give courts, and should we give courts, the discretion to say, set aside that personal bias and tell us you can be fair and let you sit? And the case law consistently has said no.
Counsel?
They said no for very good and strong policy reasons. We don't want someone's brother sitting on a jury just because he nods yes and says, I can be fair and impartial.
Counsel, I take it you were the trial counsel?
I was.
When the challenge for cause was made, help me understand what was said to the judge and what did the judge respond? Because, I mean, I look at this and you have three strikes, not just one against the against the juror, including a factual pattern that's almost identical to the case before them. So what justification did the judge give other than the words that we see from the juror saying, I can be fair and impartial?
Judge, very candidly, from being in the process, the particular juror was a state trooper. He was a lieutenant in the highway patrol. And I think judges have leaned over backwards, and we as lawyers in civil cases have leaned over backwards to let police officers sit on civil jurors. And he wanted to believe in his heart, Judge Travis wanted to believe in his heart, that when a police officer says, I can follow the law and I can follow the facts and set aside the fact that my whole family works for this company, that he believed him. And that's why he let him sit. And you're right, there were multiple reasons under the principal challenge why the judge should have excluded this juror, including the fact, which made it prejudicial to us, that we were out of peremptory challenges at that point.
If we were to rule against you on the issue of law, can we still rule for you on abuse of discretion? I mean, it certainly seems like there's an abuse issue here.
Well, the issue on abuse of discretion goes then to the challenge under J in point 4.3. And the judge actually made his ruling on allowing the juror to sit under the for the favor, to the favor challenge. So if you can say, and I think you can say in this case, that there was an abuse of discretion on that portion of his ruling, yes, you can rule our way and still not decide on the principal challenge. But frankly, Justice Stratton, the case law in Ohio is horribly confused on this issue. It needs to be straightened out. You need to reestablish 300 years of precedent. You need to go back to Blackstone's commentaries and say, that man had it right in the 1700s. Principal challenges are something that cannot be set aside just by an inquiry as to whether you can be fair and impartial. This case is enormous.
Does that then take a bright line test and the challenges up through J, up to J, subject to the validity determination by the court, are absolute?
Absolutely, Your Honor. And I think you need to reaffirm that to the lower courts in Ohio in order to avoid all of the misconceptions. And frankly, the misconceptions come out of your prior ruling in Burke versus Matthews, where you decided that Section J, and that was a Section J case, was a to-the-favor challenge. And there's some language in the opinion that says the court has discretion to determine challenges for cause. And lower courts have interpreted that to mean that that applies to all of the initial nine sections. And it's just wrong. It's wrong historically, it's wrong for the people of Ohio, and it's wrong for the impartiality of juries. I'd like to retain 4 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Kelm. Mr. Kincaid.
Thank you, Chief Justice, members of the court.
Mr. Kincaid, I take it that you don't agree that there ought to be a absolute bright line test?
I disagree. I do not agree there should be a bright line test. One of the things, Your Honor, that at common law, if you adopt this statute is a codification of common law, there was a bright line test at common law because triors were trying these principal challenges. If you look at Blackstone, if you look at Lord Coke translating Blackstone, the actual jurors were picking triors to try some of these challenges, and that's why they were bright line tests. There's two points I would like to make in this argument. Number one, the prior decisions of this court over the last 80 years have determined that challenges for cause under 2313.42 are discretionary. Point one. The second point is that there is no evidence of any legislative intent to deny the trial court's discretion under 2313.42.
Mr. Kincaid, if we look at the items that the conduct that the General Assembly has indicated are principal challenges, subject to principal challenges A through I, these are all situations, circumstances in which I don't think we'd have those persons sitting as a juror, would we, even if we they could somehow convince a trial court? I mean, it just seems to me that he has an action pending between him and either party, or he has an interest in the cause. Those are sort of standard kind of reasons for not having someone put in a position of trying to say they can be impartial. We just assume that they cannot be, even if they can be. The appearance of having someone with these circumstances is not good for the system, is it?
No, I agree. And in many of these challenges in A through I, that's exactly the case. That's not the case with C, and this court addressed that issue in Maddox. And I don't believe it's the case in E, which is the statutes that is the subject of this appeal. The bank, the employer that we're talking about here, and the court's been provided with transcript. I mean, we're talking about an employer who employed 75,000 people. We're talking about a parent of an employee of Bank One.
But I guess the 75,000, what difference does that make? If it's my son and my children who are employed by the bank, and they have a pretty good position with the bank and all the other, the mortgage issues and so forth, it seems to me that just the appearance of someone sitting in judgment of a case such as this, the appearance of that, to me, flies in the face of all of our principles of impartiality and fairness and justice. Doesn't the General Assembly made that decision for us? Just decide there's some circumstances that we're going to declare to be for a juror, you know, the juror can't, we just aren't even going to assume that a juror could be impartial in situations such as this, even if they can be, at least for the sake of the system, the appearance of the fairness of the judgments, it would seem to me that the statute should be applied strictly.
Let me answer the question first. I don't think in this case that is true. I think on a prima facie basis, there could be an appearance of impropriety, and that's how Blackstone defined a principal challenge, was on a prima facie basis. He never defined it on a per se basis. I think in this day and age, and we've suggested a hypothetical in our brief, but a class action, if one of the members of the jury is a member of a class action against Nationwide, whether that juror believes in that class action or has any idea what the class action's about, would not be able to sit on a jury involving a case involving Nationwide Insurance. In this case, there was no nexus, Your Honor, whatsoever between this juror other than the employment relationship with the two children.
The nexus seems to be stronger with the fact that you had one child terminated under almost identical fact patterns in reorganization, and you've got a father who's saying, well, my daughter didn't complain, and what's this woman complaining about? I mean, that appearance is huge. I mean, that's bigger to me than the two other children working for them still, the fact that you had an almost identical fact pattern as the case.
First of all, the statute wouldn't apply to that specific situation. It does not apply without discretion to a parent of an employee, former employee of an employer. But I agree with you that there is an issue with respect to the daughter. We took a risk because that juror could have been a very bad juror for Bank One, as well as a very bad juror for the plaintiff. And no one knew which way that was going to come out. The judge in this case took an extraordinary, we voir dired this juror for probably a half hour. And the judge, Judge Travis in this case, took an exceptional amount of time trying to, I think he agonized with this decision. He had a similar decision.
Counsel, I think we're all wondering why. Why take a half an hour?
Mr. Kelm took 20 minutes. I took 10.
No. But why do it at all?
Because in
the face of this, I mean, my experience with trials is when it's in the statute, when some juror says something that just, potential juror, that you just instinctively know they shouldn't be on this jury. Usually, both lawyers just, you know, what one may say for cause, or the judge may even jump in to say, I'm going to excuse this. They don't put the juror through a half an hour inquiry.
Well, the judge didn't put the juror through the half hour. He allowed it because I think he felt a very real responsibility to make sure that juror wasn't pressured, that the juror wasn't rehabilitated, and that the juror honestly believed he could sit and be a fair and impartial juror.
Counsel, were there other individuals available to be jurors in the case?
Was this
the last individual in the courtroom?
No, this was not the last individual in the courtroom. This was the second day that we picked this jury, so it was the morning of the second day, and we had lost a juror overnight. We had lost a couple of jurors that morning because of sick children. But no, this was not the last juror. One of the points I would like to make is the legislative intent with respect to this issue of whether or not these are per se exclusions, and that's really what we're talking about.
Issue for us, obviously.
Beg your pardon, Your Honor?
That's the legal issue for us that we have to decide in this case. You're right.
Is whether or not they're presumptive. The legislature didn't use the word presumptively biased or per se disqualified or shall exclude or shall not serve as a juror. And contrary to what appellant's counsel said, The statute doesn't say they shall be removed. If the legislature meant a mandatory dismissal of these jurors, it would have said mandatory dismissal. Since Maddox was decided, this statute has been amended 5 separate times. The legislature is presumed to know and be aware of this court's decisions, and they certainly were in Maddox. And clearly in that case, the court held that a principal challenge, if the juror can be fair and impartial, does not require disqualification of that juror. 5 separate times they amended the statute after that decision, and not once did they disagree with this court's conclusion with respect to that discretion. One of the things I would like to address, if it pleases the court, is the issue of discretion in the job the trial court has in voir dire. And I know many of you have served long careers as trial judges. It's the task of the trial judge to find the proper balance in any case. It's not the judge's duty in voir dire to extract a right answer. It's not a judge's duty to rehabilitate a juror. The objective of a challenge for cause is to remove jurors who cannot act impartially. And the trial judge needs to focus on the totality of circumstances in the courtroom at the time that decision's being made. Experience, conduct, statements, opinions, associations of the jurors, whatever. If there is a legitimate question about the ability of the person to act impartially, then the court should remove that person. We had an identical situation here with a lawyer from Jones Day who had represented Bank One in a securities deal. That lawyer expressed the opinion, he just hesitated, expressed some apprehension at sitting on that jury. He was challenged for cause, and that challenge was sustained immediately. This is a case where this judge followed this court's opinions in Maddox and Burke, and the other courts of appeals who decided this case felt that this juror could be impartial and fair and unbiased, and that's why that challenge was overruled. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Kincaid. Mr. Kelm, you've saved a little more than four and a half minutes of your time.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Counsel, let me ask, before you get started, and I'm looking back through the record because I can't recall, was this a unanimous verdict?
It was. Wait a second. It was not. It was a 7-1 verdict. I believe that's right. Yeah, I'm not sure, but I believe that's right. I think it's a 7-1 verdict.
And this juror became the foreman.
He became the foreman, and he had the jurors wearing coordinated colors every day as they came to court. They wore brown one day, gray one day. He was a manipulative person. I've never seen that happen before. I've tried a lot of cases.
Or a good leader.
At least he didn't eye for color.
Yeah, it was very unusual.
We're all wearing black, by the way.
But your tie is green this week.
Well, it's a special week, you know. Day on Saturday.
Let me say one thing that Mr. Kincaid raised, the fact that the statute itself doesn't say that the juror must be disqualified. But remember, this statute is the embodiment of the common law. And at common law, principal challenges were automatic disqualification. And in the statute, it says each challenge listed in this section should be considered as a principal challenge, and its validity tried by the court means had discretion to determine whether you satisfy the principal challenge. If so, the juror is disqualified. Now, I think there are three issues embedded in the issues of this case that if you really want to clarify the law in Ohio, you should address. The first issue is the one that is mainly raised. The principal challenges under A through I are mandatory. The only discretion is to determine whether they're met. The second issue
is if a principal challenge is established under A through I, may the juror ever be rehabilitated using the fair and impartial standard under J or 43? And that's what the trial or the appellate courts are in confusion about and what the trial judge should hear. In other words, can point 4.2 be judicially amended to require a two-step process? Establish first that there's a principal challenge, then determine whether they're fair and impartial. We think it cannot be. I think you're just rewriting the legislative determination there. But third, and this is an interesting issue that needs to be addressed, is it prejudicial error to refuse a principal challenge under A through I if a peremptory challenge is available and used to exclude a juror? That comes up in a lot of cases, and there's a lot of cases, including Supreme Court cases, prior Supreme Court cases, that say, oh, well, they could use a peremptory challenge. They got that objectionable juror off that they had a principal challenge to, no harm, no foul. And it's a tough issue. And in this case, we were done with peremptory challenges, so it's not an issue in this case, but it's one that constantly arises. Do you have to be forced to use one of your peremptory challenges to remove someone who should be disqualified under A through I? And I think that's an issue that needs to be addressed, because the lower courts consistently, even in ones where they use a challenge to the favor as a basis for really overruling what would otherwise be a principal challenge, they say, oh, well, there's no harm. He had a peremptory challenge. He used it to exclude that juror. That's a key issue. Frankly, I don't have good answers on whether in fact, if you have to use a peremptory challenge, that so prejudices you that you should reverse the verdict below. I don't know the answer to that question, but I think it is something that clearly it will be repeated over and over in our trial courts and needs to be answered as a part of this case. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Kelm. The case is submitted. You'll be advised of our opinion.